Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your host, Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and archived permanently at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do an article, 100 Years Ago Today, The Trial of Leo Frank Begins, talking about one of these signal events in the 20th century in terms of a harbinger of Jewish takeover, Jewish political power, and a perfect microcosmic expression of Jewish values and Jewish attitudes toward non-Jews. And we will be going through a lot of material. What we have to start with is fairly brief. Let's get to it. And this was originally published by the editor on July 28, 2013 at theamericanmercury.org. TheAmericanMercury.org. And that's a famous name that H.L. Mencken, my hero, was associated with about 100 years ago. Now, the trial began 100 years ago, and the title of the article, again, is 100 Years Ago Today, The Trial of Leo Frank Begins. Take a journey through time with the American Mercury and experience the trial of Leo Frank, pictured in the courtroom sketch for the murder of Mary Fagan, just as it happened and as revealed in contemporary accounts. The Mercury will be covering this historic trial in capsule form from now until August 26th, the 100th anniversary of the rendering of the verdict. That's all in italics, by Bradford L. Huey, H-U-I-E. The Jewish Anti-Defamation League, ADL, the article begins, in great contrast to the American Mercury and other independent media, has given hardly any publicity to the 100th anniversary of the murder of Mary Fagan and the arrest and trial of Leo Frank, despite the fact that these events eventually led to the foundation of the ADL, founded to protect a convicted, multiple times convicted, all levels of the process convicted and affirmed pedophile and murderer because he's a Jew. That's all that ever mattered to the ADL. That's how much they hate non-Jews, how little respect they have, what utter and complete contempt they have for non-Jews, for Gentiles, particularly for whites. Loxism, as I've called their specific hatred of whites, and anti-gentilism more generally, their hatred of all who aren't them. Probably the League is saving its PR blitz for 1915, not only because that is the centenary of Leo Frank's death by lynching, an event of possibly much greater interest to the League's wealthy donors than the death of Mary Fagan, a mere Gentile factory girl, but also because encouraging the public to read about Frank's trial might not be good for the ADL. It might well lead to doubts about the received narrative, which posits an obviously innocent Frank, persecuted by anti-Semitic Southerners looking for a Jewish scapegoat. And the Frank case is mentioned fairly. I have a Google News alert on it. Google is a Jewish utility. And papers will mention Frank or Frank-related stuff fairly often, and the history that is fake, that is fiction, that the Jews are trying to put across is that the only memorable thing is that anti-Semitism in the U.S. and in the South specifically led an innocent Frank to being lynched for something he didn't do. The fact is, he did do it. He and his well-paid goy handlers and the Jews who put up the money tried to blame it on others, a couple of black men, as they love to call them. But the honest white men of Georgia didn't let them get away with it. Tom Watson in particular, we've heard from in other tapings. A writer and political figure back then ran a newspaper and a monthly, I think it was, magazine as well. For readers not familiar with the case, a good place to start is Scott Aaron's summary of the crime from his The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Lynching of Leo Frank, which states in part, again, Scott Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, summary of the crime in The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Lynching of Leo Frank. And you can find more information on that at leofrank.info. Now, this will be a quotation from The Murder of Mary Fagan and The Lynching of Leo Frank. Three paragraphs. On Saturday morning at 11:30, April 26, 1913, Mary Fagan ate a poor girl's lunch of bread and boiled cabbage and said goodbye to her mother for the last time. Dressed for parade watching, for this was Confederate Memorial Day, in a lavender dress, ribbon-bedecked hat, and parasol, she left her home in hardscrabble working-class Bellwood at 11:45 and caught the streetcar for downtown Atlanta. Before the festivities, though, she stopped to see Superintendent Leo M. Frank at the National Pencil Company and pick up from him her $1.20 pay for the one day she had worked there during the previous week. Almost no one knew it at the time, but by 1 o'clock, one young life was already over. For her, there would never again be parades or music or kisses or flowers or children or love. Mary Fagan never left the National Pencil Company alive. Abused, beaten, and strangled by a rough cord pulled so tightly that it had embedded itself deeply in her girlish neck and made her tongue protrude more than an inch from her mouth, Mary Fagan lay dead, dumped in the dirt and shavings of the Pencil Company basement, her once bright eyes now sightless and still as she lay before the gaping maw of the furnace where the factory trash was burned. In Georgia 1913, it was customary in criminal cases for all of the prosecution and defense witnesses to be sworn before any of their testimony was taken. Yes, they batch processed them, so to speak. In the hot and crowded temporary Fulton County courtroom at 10 a.m. on July 28, 1913, Solicitor Hugh Dorsey called his witnesses and they were duly sworn. But the Leo Frank defense team, and he had the best defense money could buy, the best lawyers in the South, the Leo Frank defense team and the persons of Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold surprised everyone by asking to have their witnesses sworn at a later time, claiming that, though they had just declared themselves fully ready to go to trial, their witness list was as yet, quote, fragmentary, unquote, and would occasion severe delays if it were required to be completed that morning. But presiding Judge Leonard Roan ruled against them, and in all of 5 minutes, the defense was ready to call their list. It turns out that the defense had wanted to conceal for a time their strategy of making Frank's character a factor in his defense and revealing the names of their witnesses, numbers of prominent Atlanta Jews, Frank's former Cornell University classmates, and others, made that strategy obvious and would give the prosecution time to find rebuttal witnesses on the subject of the character of Leo Frank. The first witness was Mrs. Fanny Coleman, Mary Fagan's mother. She described her last moments with her daughter on the morning of the previous April 26th. When asked to identify the clothes that 13-year-old Mary had worn that day, she broke down. There's a picture of Mary Fagan's aunt, mother, and sister. Kind of a drawing or photo, I'm not sure which. There were three or four newspapers in town, I think three, that were covering this daily that we will hear from eventually as we go on and add material to our archive about this. The next witness called was 15-year-old George Epps, E-P-P-S, who said he's ridden on the trolley car with little Mary from 11:50 a.m. to 12:07 p.m. when she disembarked to go see Superintendent Leo Frank at the National Pencil Company and pick up her pay. The exact timing of Mary's visit to Frank was to become very important later in the case, and we'll also learn, I don't know if they talk about it here, but Frank had refused to give her paycheck to her friend, as he had done in the past, because he wanted her to go there and be alone with him so he could attack her. Try to debauch her as he had other Aryan virgin women. Girls. The third prosecution witness, Newt Lee, the Pencil Company's night watchman and the man who found Mary Fagan's bruised body in the factory basement in the wee hours of April 27th, was very damaging to Frank. Lee stated that he had arrived at work early, at 4 p.m. on the day of the murder, at the explicit instructions of Frank, who had said he was planning to attend a baseball game with a relative. So he killed her in between 12 and 1, and then he had the black eye factory watchman come in at 4. But when Lee came to the factory at 4, Frank appeared very nervous and agitated and said that Lee should leave immediately and come back at 6. When Lee said he'd rather rest for a while at the factory building than go out, Frank insisted that he must go out for 2 hours. When Lee did come back, Frank was still acting strangely and became extremely agitated when, around the same time, a friend of Mary Fagan's and a former worker at the plant, J.M. Gant, showed up and asked to retrieve some shoes he'd left on the premises. Frank was so nervous that he fumbled the routine task of putting Lee's slip into the time clock, taking twice as long as usual. After Frank went home, he telephoned Lee to ask him if everything was all right, quote unquote, something that Lee had never said he had never done before. So he's acting suspicious, he's acting sweaty, he's acting guilty, he's acting the way someone who knew what he had done and knew that it was a bad thing, he's acting like a bad dog. Lee told the court that, the day after the murder, Frank had told authorities in his presence that Lee's time slip for the previous night had been punched correctly. Another block quote here. When did you see Frank? I saw Mr. Frank Sunday morning at about 7 or 8. He was coming in the office. How did he look to you? He looked down at the floor. He never spoke to me. He dropped his head down this way. Was any examination made of the time clock? Boots Rogers, Chief Lanford, Darley, Mr. Frank and I were there when they opened the clock. Mr. Frank opened the clock and said the punches were all right. What did he mean by all right? It meant that I hadn't missed any punches. So they hire a night watchman. He has to punch the clock every hour or half hour to prove he's making his rounds. This was ominous testimony from Leo Frank's point of view. As part of an apparent attempt to incriminate Newt Lee, Frank had later told police that Lee had missed several punches, implying that he had time to be involved in the murder. So he's lying. At first he says the time card is punched appropriately, correctly, and then later he says it's not. Around the same time, a bloody shirt was planted on Lee's property. It was detected as a fake when the pattern of stain showed it had not been worn when stained, but had been crumpled up and wiped in blood. Rosser's cross-examination of Lee that day could not shake him in any element of his story. So again, this is at a time when blacks are a lot less respected than today, and the Jews are relying on this attitude in order to try to blame this black and get their own guy off. Another picture. Opposing lawyers in Frank case. Luther Rosser and solicitor Hugh Dorsey. The following is a direct transcription of a part of the coverage of the first day of the trial in the Atlanta Constitution, remember, one of the three papers, July 29th, 1913. Watchman tells of finding body of Mary Fagan. Mother and the wife of prisoner cheer him by presence at trial. Jury is quickly secured, and Mrs. Coleman, mother of the murdered girl, is first witness to take stand. Dateline, Atlanta, Georgia, July 28th, 1913. Remember, the murder had occurred in April 26th or 27th, that period. So, May, June, July, 3 months later, the trial is going on almost to the day, 3 months later. And this report is filed July 28th, 1913. With a swiftness which was gratifying to counsel for the defense, the Solicitor General and a large crowd of interested spectators, the trial of Leo M. Frank, charged with the murder of Mary Fagan on April 26th in the building of the National Pencil Factory, was gotten underway Monday. When the hour of adjournment for the day had arrived, the jury had been selected and three witnesses had been examined. Newt Lee, the night watchman who discovered the dead body of Mary Fagan in the basement of the National Pencil Factory and who gave the first news of the crime to the police, was still on the stand, undergoing a rigid cross-examination by Luther Z. Rosser, attorney for Frank. All that done in one day, and this was to become the biggest trial, essentially, ever in Georgia state history. The most money spent on it, the most publicity. Subtitle in the story, Lee sticks to first story. When the trial is resumed this morning, Newt Lee will again be placed on the stand. It is not expected that anything new will be adduced from his testimony. Throughout the grueling cross-examination of Mr. Rosser Monday afternoon, Lee stuck to his original story in minutest detail. Questions that would have confused or befuddled a man of education failed to budge him from the statement he originally made to the police, and has repeated from time to time to reporters and court officials. The first day's proceedings of the Frank trial proved singularly free of the dramatic element or the unexpected in testimony. There were touches of the pathetic, as, for example, when Mrs. J.W. Coleman, and they just mean sad in that usage, mother of the dead child, broke down and cried bitterly when she viewed the clothing of her little daughter. And there were touches of humor when the little Epps boy, who had ridden to town with Mary Fagan on the day of her murder, explained to Luther Rosser his method of telling the time of day by the sun, and of Newt Lee, who amused the courtroom by his quaint allusions and his Negro descriptions of a tiny light in the basement of the pencil factory, which he likened to the gleam of a lightning bug, and of his quick retort when Mr. Rosser purposely spoke of this insect as a June bug. "I didn't say June bug. I said lightning bug," contradicted Newt. Careful attention to detail. This brief excerpt is given as significant of the careful attention to detail that Lee gave to his story. When the hour of 9 o'clock arrived, Pryor Street, in front of the temporary courthouse building, was cluttered with the usual mob of the morbidly curious. Morbid means diseased. They lugged the hot walls of the building like lethargic leeches. They hugged the hot walls of the building like lethargic leeches, vainly trying to gain admission to the building, or buzzed about like bees, gossiping idly of the case. Perfect order was maintained, however, and few not directly interested in the trial were allowed to enter the courtroom. All day long, the crowd remained on the sidewalks, gazing intently at the window to the courtroom, spewing tobacco juice on the street, eagerly questioning every person who left the building. Interest naturally centered on the appearance in court of Leo M. Frank, the accused. If Frank has chafed under his confinement, his physical appearance belies the fact. He looked as physically fit as he did the day he was first arrested. He was dressed with scrupulous neatness in a gray suit of pronounced pattern, which was all the more conspicuous on account of his diminutive form. He was a little guy. As he entered the courtroom, he smiled cordially at several friends. The first person to whom he spoke was a woman employee of the pencil factory. Next in interest was Mrs. Leo M. Frank, wife of the accused, and a Jew, who, up to this time, has been seen little in public. Mrs. Frank is an extremely attractive-looking young woman. During progress of the trial, she kept her eyes constantly fixed on Solicitor Dorsey. Her gaze was one of calm estimate. She seemed to be attempting to fathom his thoughts and to divine his purposes. Mrs. Coleman takes stand. Efforts to show Mary Fagan's attitude toward Leo M. Frank by the state, and efforts by the defense to show the dead girl's attitude toward little George Epps, the 14-year-old newsie who testified to riding downtown with her on the morning before she was found dead, were the first important things attempted yesterday when the trial of the state versus Leo M. Frank, charged with the Fagan girl's murder on April 26, was formally opened. Both efforts were promptly blocked for the present time by opposing counsel, and the testimony was started in regular form by the introduction of Mrs. J.W. Coleman, mother of Mary Fagan, as the first witness for the state. During the preliminaries, attorneys Reuben R. Arnold and Luther Z. Rosser for Frank tried to conceal the names of their witnesses, but on Solicitor Hugh M. Dorsey's objections, they were overruled by trial judge L.S. Roan, and they called and swore their witnesses as the state had done but a few moments previously. So they wanted to withhold. Revealing their witnesses would reveal their strategy, so they tried to sneak out of what was customary at the time, which is listing and swearing the witnesses up front. The judge correctly wouldn't let them do that. In a comeback for this, the defense asked the court to honor their duces tecum, in which they previously served upon the solicitor, requiring him to bring into court all statements and affidavits made by James Connolly, the Negro sweeper, who made an affidavit incriminating himself and declaring he had aided Frank in disposing of the girl's body. Solicitor Dorsey, after a conference with Frank A. Hooper, a brilliant criminal lawyer aiding him, dictated a statement to the court stenographer in which he agreed to produce these affidavits and statements at the proper time should they be held material. Defense announces ready. The case started promptly at 9 o'clock, with the courtroom thronged with veneer men and spectators, witnesses and lawyers and friends of the principal. I think that means people who are going to be called to possibly be on the jury. They have a Latin term for that, voir dire, whatever it is, right at the start, where they ask you questions and they can peremptorily reject people for whatever reason they want until the court found that racist later, decades later, and wouldn't let them throw out blacks for being blacks or whites for being whites. Anyway, side point. So the case started promptly at 9 o'clock. Courtroom thronged with veneer men and spectators, witnesses and lawyers, and friends of the principal. Contrary to the persistent rumor that the defense would ask postponement, and to their frequent objections to the trial in the heated term, the defense proved ready and willing to go to trial. ... You can read the entire Atlanta Constitution for this day by downloading this PDF file. There's a link, americanmercury.org/2013/07/100-years-ago-today-the-trial-of-leo-frank-begins/. But if you go to the American Mercury, you can find anything you want to about all this. And I think at leofrank.org, too. You can read the entire Atlanta Constitution for this day by downloading this PDF file. The complete Atlanta Georgian, second paper, can be downloaded here. And the entire Atlanta Journal, the third paper, can be read by downloading this file. Remember, again, before really the age of electronics, before the age of the Internet, of course, the big thing was newspapers. And there were three dailies in Atlanta. And it was not unusual in that regard. New York would have had 8 or 10, plus some in other languages. Whereas today, you might get one daily per large city, even. So you can read the PDF of these daily newspaper reports, which we are going to do in audiobook form as part of this as we move along. Now, just a little more, and then we'll be done with this for today, this sort of quick start that we're doing. Make sure to check out the full American Mercury series in the Leo Frank case by clicking here, and we also have a lot that we've recorded already at vnnforum.com, as I said, and alexlinder.com. The American Mercury will be following these events of 100 years ago, the month-long trial of Leo M. Frank for the brutal murder of Miss Mary Fagan. Follow along with us and experience the trial as Atlantans of a century ago did, and come to your own conclusions. A fearless scholar, dedicated to the truth about this case, has obtained, scanned, and uploaded every single relevant issue of the major Atlanta daily newspapers, and they now can be accessed through the archive.org as follows. Through archive.org. /details/Leo Frank case in the Atlanta Constitution newspaper 1913 to 1915. That's one. And again, archive.org/details/Atlanta Georgian newspaper April to August 1913. And the third one is archive.org/details/Atlanta Journal April 28, 1913 to August 31st. Or August 31, 1913. More background on the case may be found in my article here at the Mercury, 100 Reasons Leo Frank is Guilty. Very much worth reading. And then other related articles are listed at the link at the American Mercury. Anyway, that will do for the start of the Leo Frank trial. As I said, we've covered much more of it at vnnforum.com in our The Massive section, and other audiobooks, and we'll be back upon this theme later. So visit the American Mercury, leofrank.org, VNN Forum or alexlinder.com to learn more. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you with more about the Leo Frank trial as we go week by week on it real soon.